Now this is Channel 2 over. This is Channel 2 over and a continuation of the session at supper on Monday the 3rd of November 69. On Monday the 3rd of November 69, continuation of that little session after supper. And this is Seatology.
One where he goes on with this thing of definitely about how he doesn't want to classify whales by their... He tells why he doesn't think whales should be classified by the internal things. And he gives a list of about 3 or 4 whales that have, three great big external characteristics. The baleen, hump, back fin, and teeth. These are the things whose peculiarities are indiscriminately dispersed among all sorts of whales, without any regard to what may be the nature of their structure and other and more essential particulars. Thus, the sperm whale and the humpback whale each has a hump, but there the similitude ceases. Then this same humpback whale and the Greenland whale, each of these has a baleen, but there again the similitude ceases. And it is just the same with the other parts above mentioned. In various sorts of whales, they form such irregular combinations, or in the case of any one of them detached, such an irregular isolation, as utterly to defy all general methodization formed upon such a basis. On this rock, every one of the whale naturalists has split. But it may possibly be conceived that, in the internal parts of the whale, in his anatomy, there at least we shall be able to hit the right classification. Nay, what thing, for example, is there in the Greenland whale's anatomy more striking than his baleen? Yet we have seen that by his baleen it is impossible correctly to classify the Greenland whale. And if you descend into the bowels of various leviathans, why there you will not find distinctions of 50th part as available to the systematizer as those external ones already enumerated. What then remains? Nothing but to take hold of the whales bodily, in their entire liberal volume, and boldly sort them that way. And this is the bibliographical system here adopted, and it is the only one that can possibly succeed, for it alone is practicable. Through the sort of used to classify the small things, the teeth or the baleen or the internal differences there might be, to try to classify anything by looking at just one part of it, can't succeed. That you must take the whole and look at the whole thing. That's the only method that will work.
His bibliography?
His bibliography.
What do you mean, bibliography?
Well, because he uses the, he terms his whales as books, the folio and the, octavo and so forth. It's on sort of the same line as the first one. Because the first one, he's using one specific classifier, and one specific point of his classification.
Like that tail?
The fact that he uses the internal, his warm binocular heart, their lungs, their eyelids, their ears, to distinguish the whale from the fish, rather than looking at the fact that both of them live in the sea. And in the other, this is specific. The other is more general. That's the main difference.
I don't follow that, but I'll take your word for it. I followed you went the other night.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was pretty well. I understood the attitude of these Emersonians, you see, towards classification, and I had run into this chapter in Ishmael's on Seatology, and I figured, well, Ishmael embraces classification.
Just looking through it, I got rather almost a sort of opposite feeling. He starts in this first section before he gets into all the separate little whales, talking about classifying, and he says, first of all, he's got to settle one point. That's whether or not a whale is a mammal or a fish. And so he starts talking about Linnaeus, the father of all this scientific classification. He says that in Linnaeus' system of nature, he stated, I hereby separate the whales from the fish. But Ishmael says, of my own knowledge, I know that down to the year 1850, sharks and shad, alewives and herring, against Linnaeus' express edict, were still found dividing the possession of the same seas with the Leviathan. The grounds upon which Linnaeus would fain have banished the whales from the waters, he states as follows. On account of their warm binocular heart, their lungs, their movable eyelids, and their hollow ears. I submitted all this to my friends Simon Macy and Charlie Coffin of Nantucket, both messmates of mine in a certain voyage, and they united in an opinion that the reasons set forth were altogether insufficient. Charlie profanely hinted they were humbugs. So Ishmael proceeds to define a whale by his obvious externals. A whale is a spouting fish with a horizontal tail.
How about that?
And there you have it.
That suits me.
Ishmael even takes a little poke with the way he classifies the whales, because he uses the page sizes that are used in printing. And his biggest whale is a folio whale. And his littlest whale is a duodecimal whale. And that's what porpoises are, duodecimals. He carries that on through. He has a good time with that. Ishmael can't be bothered with this internal classification of Linnaeus likes so much. He decides one of his little talks on the finback whale, he decides he'll tell you why. If you descend into the bowels of the various leviathans, why there you will find not distinctions of there you will not find distinctions of 50th part as available to the systematizer as those external ones already enumerated. What then remains? Nothing but to take hold of the whales bodily in their entire liberal volume and boldly sort them that way. And this is the bibliographical system here adopted, and it is the only one that can possibly succeed, for it alone is practicable.
And that?
You can't just...
We got the idea.
This bibliographical system he uses is just this taking these book sizes, and he divides all whales into three or four separate books. The folio books, which are the large whales, and the book two is a medium-sized whale, the octavos. And then each whale is a chapter in the book. So you have a complete volume of four books with several chapters, which includes all the whales. So Ishmael, rather than just grabbing hold of this idea of classify. He classifies all right, but it wouldn't classify very many scientists. He finishes up his books and says that he's not through with them, that he can't be through with them. He says, it was stated at the outset that this system would not be here and at once perfected. You cannot plainly see that I've kept my word, but I now leave my cetological system standing thus unfinished, even as the great cathedral of Cologne was left with the crane still standing upon the top of the uncompleted tower. For small erections may be finished by their first architects. Grand ones, true ones, ever leave the copestone to posterity. God keep me from ever completing anything. So, Ishmael's not one to just close off something, finish it up. just got to leave it open.
Yes, Linnaeus laid the groundwork. But see, the next generations would still be working on Linnaeus' classification, so it behooves...
He can't close his off.
No, he can't close his off. That would argue a poor system, wouldn't it?
Pretty poor.
This is Channel 2 over. This is Channel 2 over. 1:15, Wednesday night, 5th of November, 69. Wednesday night, 5th of November, 69. Channel 2 over. 1:15.
Is that... little report on Cookie. You know, Guy, you told me to check in there with Alvin, and I thought the best thing to do, since I didn't see Alvin, was to check in with Cookie. So I did. There he was with his head under the hood of a car and his cigar in his mouth. And I said, Cookie, did you blow up? Cigar and all, and he grinned. I swear I don't know how he keeps that cigar in his mouth under the hood of a car. Just don't know. And I told him I was going to have something done. And he said, I told them boys they ought to clean that carburetor. It was Alvin who said there wasn't anything wrong with it. But anyway, Cookie said, now go over there to Bill. Don't go to Red, go to Bill. So I went over to Bill. Bill got in the car, and he took one of those little quick looks at it. And he said, your heater's not working. I said, you telling me? So he ran back into the office, into his little shop, came back with something, looked like a runner screwdriver. He did something and he says, working now. So I asked him if he wouldn't just tell me what he did. He said, no, it's a secret. Started my day. Bill said, Alvin's all tied up. He can't work on it today. I said, well, I don't believe I can go home in it tonight. He said, no, you can't drive it back. He said, you just got one choice. Just leave it. We'll get to it when we can. He said, that's all we can do. I said, well, that's all I'll do then. He said, it's got to be fixed. He said, you're losing half a tank of gasoline. I said, yeah, I thought so. So I went over there, told Cookie I was going to leave it. About that time, a little boy came up and said he'd drive me home. And Cookie sort of ran back and said, you don't need to drive her home. She can drive herself. And I didn't know. What could he add to mine? He said, you just wait here a minute. And I waited there a minute. And around the corner came this pink car. And Cookie drove it up in front of me like a chauffeur. And he sat there a minute. And I said, Cookie, what is all this about? You just might need a car today. And this one is yours. He said, I'll show you a little something. Well, when you start it, Guy and Barbara, you can't just turn the ignition key. You got to put it in reverse. And then you got to push the neutral slot. And you got to hold your fingers on both of them while you turn the key. I'm just missing a switch. He had me practice it two or three times and I could see myself get installed somewhere. But anyway, it worked. But you've never seen anybody as proud of offering a car as Cookie was. And I was proud. And so I sallied off in that pink car. And Bill told me as I rode away, you don't need any other car, you got one. Just let me tell you, when I finished working at 5 o'clock, I took Cookie's car back down there, because Cookie said he's going to leave at 5:30. So I drove it back, parked it, went in where my car was. There stood Cookie, cigar in his mouth and hand in his pocket. Not doing a thing but watching Bob work on my car. And Bill was standing there too. And they all had suggestions. I, as if, now this car is really important, as if they knew I was coming. And Cookie didn't leave until about 6:15. He came over and sort of said to me out of the corner of his mouth, "It's all right." And he said, "I got to go put a muffler on my car at 6:15. And his car had been there all that time, but he stood there and looked at my car. And I said, "Cookie, appreciate the use of your car." And he said, just born to the purpose. When I said, "I just drove it to the house, and it sat in the yard the whole time. But it was good to know that I had a car if I needed it." Cookie said, "If you'd have drove it 100 miles, it'd been all the same. I'm proud."
I think all except for about hour or so this evening, and that time I was with you this morning, I've been on a horse one way or another.
Yeah.
Why Barbara?
I rode Pussy this morning and took her out that back field, and we worked on all the things that she's supposed to do with those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she just performed. She was so proud. I never thought she had it in her. I don't know whether it was the day or what. I've seen her with the kids, actually. She's got, not, I said she was a good schoolgirl.
Yes, she did.
But she was just so willing to do whatever I wanted her to do, as long as she understood it. And she'd do those circles, and she's not like Molly. She didn't go around fighting the bit all the time. She just curves her back and fits right into the circle. And she'd come up to the bit and get her little hind legs underneath her and raise her head up a little bit. I don't know what she looked like. I couldn't see her, but she felt good.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just doing herself proud. So after she'd been working for a bit, I just took her off and rode her. I'd just been riding her in the school, which is pretty cramped space. A horse that's not really used to it. So I took her off around the pasture, and we had a good gallop. And she can move, that little horse.
Yeah.
She can move. She loves it, too.
Uh-huh.
And so we came back. We worked on something she didn't understand for a bit. And she wasn't so happy about that. We worked on taking her leads on the canter.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't figured her out, and she hadn't figured me out. And between us, we stay confused a good bit of the time on that.
Well, you know, Johnny always said, you don't have to teach her leads. She knows what lead to take. He never would.
Well,
doesn't make any sense.
For knowing what lead to take, she sure ends up on the wrong one more than any horse I ever saw.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be when you're teaching a horse to lead, if you start him in a large circle and just urge him into canter, most horses will pick up the lead on the leg in the direction they're going, unless they're Pussy. And she takes up the other lead. Now, maybe she likes cantering around the circle on the wrong lead. I don't know.
It'd be a little awkward if she got in a close corner.
It might be, yeah. But I finally got it. I wouldn't say I've taught her anything. We've managed to get on the right lead a few times in each direction. That's the most I'll say. Because neither one of us are quite sure what the other one's doing on that. I don't know which way to lean.
Well, I don't.
After that, I tried teaching her leg yielding a little bit, just going away from the leg. You know, she won't do that. She'll do it on a circle. You can make her circle bigger. She's going around in a circle, and you use the inside leg against her. She'll go out away from it. And this is what she should do. But if you have her by a fence, and you want her to go away from the fence, and you use your leg, she's just as likely to go into the fence as she is to go away from it. Mm-hmm. She just gets stubborn and she starts backing up and doing all sorts of stupid things. And
I'm glad
she
gets a guy's horse.
Yeah. Well, she just, I don't know what it is. Because I did a bit of half pass with her, which is going away from the leg. It's moving sort of sideways. And she did that. And yet she won't take a direct command. See, that's sort of subtle because you're using the reins and the against her neck as well. And she perhaps understands that better than she does a direct command from the leg without any sort of rein aid, which is what I was trying to do. And she got so mad, she stomped her feet. I had her up here against the shed. I tried to get to use the fence, and she was so stubborn about it that I couldn't use the fence because I knew she'd go right into the barbed wire. She was just being that ornery about it. So I came down here where I had some boards for her to run into instead of wire. And she backed up, and she rammed her ear into the boards and tucked her nose down into her chest and snorted and stomped her feet and practically reared and anything to keep from having to move sideways. And yet she'll do it when she's moving if it's not direct like that. She's just, I don't know. I think what I'll do, well, I might be able to do it with spurs. But I don't know. It might be she's just not ready for that yet. Let's say if you meet that much resistance in a horse, he's not ready.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just force them, no. Anytime you meet that much resistance in a horse, it's because the horse thinks that he physically can't do it. Mm-hmm. I've seen this with young horses on circle, on the lunge.
Mm-hmm.
If you start them on too small a circle, they get real upset. And I know I was watching one girl ride a horse, and she was having to do. The horse would do big circles, but when it started, it had to do a circle in half the school. And it started. It just would get about halfway around it, and then it would look like something would hit it and go crazy. It would just rear. It'd turn and whirl and buck. And then she finally got enough control of it to make it keep going in a straight line, but it wouldn't do a circle. It'd go veering way out. Mm-hmm. And then it cut sharp back in. And I asked Seabet, she says, the horse just can't do it yet. He's not physically capable of bending his back. And he'll do it for a little bit, and then it starts to bother him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the horse would get upset. And this is what Pussy was doing at the end. So I won't push her into that, I don't think. I meant to jump her today, and I never got around to that. On a gate standing.
Now what's that?
That's when you stand at a gate and just stand there and do nothing.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
This was such a marvelous day to ride. It was nippy enough.
It was fabulous. I took Molly. Took Molly out. We were going to go to the store, and we got there. And I had that Western saddle on her. So I say, well, I just take her on the road a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we rode down toward River Styx. And she was feeling so good. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, I just let her do that slow trot. She had a good long workout.
Mm.
And she came back just as fresh as she went out. But,
I thought about this as a good day to ride. I've
been comfortable in that saddle. I don't know whether I was sitting differently or whether I've just been riding more now and I've relaxed more or what, but it was the first time I've been comfortable in that Western saddle.
No.
And I just, we got almost, we got down to the corner, you know, where the road joins.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, well, do I really want to come out? I mean, you know, nothing has really happened on this ride. It's been very pleasant, but nothing's really happened. And I just wonder where maybe I should have gone exploring, done something, gone someplace I haven't gone before. And we went around the corner and on down. All of a sudden, Molly stopped dead. And I was looking off into the swamp. And I turned around, and there was an old coon just crossing the road. Broad daylight. He stopped in the middle of the road and peered around a minute and walked on across the road. And I figured that was enough.
Yeah.
Stared at the river and the fishermen a couple of minutes and then came back. So I've seen a coon.
Ever?
The zoo, but then they don't look like, somehow animals in a zoo don't ever look real.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of seen coons as being a little bit round and more cuddlesome, and he was an old lean flop coon with those long front feet. And I always thought they had, I never realized their arms were that long, sticking out in front of them.
It has tail.
Mm-hmm.
You say Pussy could go on a concrete pasture for a while?
Well, there are some people I know that might just do that to her, but that's being a little bit strict. I think she could have easily gone into that field up there, the front field, before you sowed it with rye, and never even noticed that she wasn't eating very much. But she's really got a lot of weight to lose, and I can't get it off of her. She's been working pretty hard, and steadily. She's been working every day.
What do you think? Maybe.
Well, hard on her. If she had a box, besides Missy's box, trouble is Missy's throwing the wrench in all the plans. She's keeping everything messed up. No, if you could just throw her in that shed at night, just let her graze during the day, that would help. Put them in a straight stall. They have to be out.
Well, I thought they'd reverse. Kept them up in the day and let them out a little at night.
Well, the most places I know do that during the summer,
mm-hmm.
when it's real hot.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they keep them up, during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them, hopefully, so they'll be away from the flies.
Mm-hmm.
And turn them out at night. But during the winter, they keep them up at night, turn them out during the day. That's why she ought to be in that concrete pasture. See, got what Lois calls that beautiful, beautiful line to her back. But it, trouble is, it dips a little in the middle. Right down her backbone. There's a little trough.
Yeah.
This is 560, and I don't know what channel. The end of the two reports on Wednesday night, the 5th of November, 69, after supper. This is 560, I don't know which side. The end of the two reports on Wednesday night, the 5th of November, 69, after supper. Faye reported on taking her car to Brazington, watching Cookie. It's a Cookie report, really. And Barbara on Pussy and Miss Molly.
Thursday night after supper, the 6th of November. Thursday night after supper, the 6th of November. The 6th of November, Thursday night after supper.
Around 370.
Around 370. Around 370. Channel 2 over.
When I was in Dick Moss's, the only people there, two boys, trying out those speakers, and it was all 40.
Tape. They like it that way. They try out their systems that way. Because you've got to come up through the soles of the feet. That bass vibration. Just got to come feel it all over. I wasn't with it. I'd never listened to any of that sort of music in high school. Most I knew about vibration was the vibration I get from a violin. You only feel that when you're actually playing it. But around the dorm, I heard Jimi Hendrix records. I didn't think much of them. I realized they were good for the type of music they were, but I didn't think much of the music. And then, the last year I was at Center, I went to a party. And they had a group, one of the really good groups. Not a big name group, because they didn't do their own stuff. They did everybody else's stuff, but they did it well. And they had these great big speakers. There are only a few groups in the country that have them. And they're supposed to be the best you can get. And they did some Jimi Hendrix. And it's an experience. It's not just hearing it. You feel it all over. And if there were anything wrong with those chords when they were played, you'd know it. They have to be perfect. There's one of the Jimi Hendrix things that starts off with four chords. And there's the four chords. And then there's a gap. And after those four chords are played, you couldn't want to hear anything else. You're just ready to just play them over again and let them stop. Just play those four chords. They aren't music. It's the vibration you get. And it just hits. And that's why these boys want to find the speakers that'll bring out that in the records. You don't get it in the records. I never realized there was anything to Jimi Hendrix in the records. Until I heard that group live.
My experience, my observation was, that boy just made you eat your words. You were belittling him the first day I was in there listening to him. On that concerto.
Well, I tell you, like, it's like this. You pull back on the reins when you figure you can get by with it. And you let up when you figure you got to. And his mama had given him a mild tranquilizer. Lucy was just getting excited all over about nothing. And she called me, and she said, it's not just this concerto he's doing. He's playing in the orchestra tonight. And he thought it was next week. And got a book report, and he lacks 40 pages, and he's reading it every minute, extra minute. And he says it's got to be in tomorrow, and he doesn't have time to get it in. And I couldn't tell him, he could have read it 2 weeks ago. But the world is simply too heavy on his shoulders today. And I said, well, I'll see what I can do to lighten the world. So fortunately, he played the concerto pretty well. And there wasn't much I could do. And he told his mother that no matter what he did, he couldn't please me. And his mother knew that all I was asking him was just to play decently. So when I acted fairly pleased about the concerto, he said I bragged on him too much. But I had to let up on him. But he likes to make music. He likes to play in ensembles. He likes to play for church. He likes to play for his friends. He likes to arrange music. He likes to just be in the business of just making music. He cares nothing at all about hearing somebody else play. And the last thing in the world he wants to do is to play in any kind of affair.
Now this is the first view of Ishmael. He said, just call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I'd sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Now, it's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Now, whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me, I count it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. Now this is the state in which he goes to sea. Now when I say that I am in the habit of going to sea whenever I begin to grow hazy about the eyes and begin to be overconscious of my lungs, I do not mean to have it inferred that I ever go to sea as a passenger. For to go to sea as a passenger, you must needs have a purse. And a purse is but a rag unless you have something in it. Besides, passengers get seasick. They grow quarrelsome. They don't sleep at night. They don't enjoy themselves much as a general thing. So I never go as a passenger. Nor, though I am something of a sort, do I ever go to sea as a commodore, or a captain, or a cook. I abandon the glory and distinction of such offices to those that like them. For my part, I abominate all honorable, respectable toils, trials, tribulations of every kind whatsoever. It is quite as much as I can do to take care of myself without taking care of the ships, barks, brigs, schooners, and whatnot. And as for going as cook, though I confess there's considerable glory in that, a cook being a sort of officer on a shipboard, yet somehow I never fancied broiling fowls, though once broiled, judiciously buttered, and judgmatically salted and peppered. There's no one who will speak more respectfully, not to say reverentially, of a broiled fowl than I will. No. When I go to sea, I go as a simple sailor. And he has had it kind of embodied, all those Emersonian qualities, and avoided all those Emersonian inhibitions. Now, landlord, I've changed my mind about that harpooner. I shan't sleep with him. I'll try the bench here. And the landlord says, now just as you please. I'm sorry I can't spare you a tablecloth for a mattress. And it's a plaguey rough board here. He said, feeling of the knots and the notches. But wait a bit, Scrim Sander. I've got a carpenter playing there in the bar. Now wait, and I'll make you snug enough. So saying, he procured the plane, and with his old silk handkerchief first dusting the bench, vigorously set to planing away at my bed, the while grinning like an ape. The shavings flew right and left, till at last the plane iron came bump against an indestructible knot. The landlord was near spraining his wrist. I told him, for heaven's sake, to quit. The bed was soft enough to suit me, and I did not know how all the planing in the world could make eiderdown off a pine plank. So gathering up the shavings with another grin and throwing them into the great stove in the middle of the room, he went about his business and left me in a brown study. Now I took the measure of the bench and found that it was a foot too short. But that could be mended with a chair, but it was a foot too narrow. And the other bench in the room was about 4 inches higher than the plain one. So there was no yoking them. I then placed the first bench lengthwise along the only clear space against the wall, leaving a little interval between for my back to settle down in. But I soon found that there came such a draft of cold air over me from under the sill of the window that this plan would never do at all, especially as another current from the rickety door met the one from the window, and both together formed a series of small whirlwinds in the immediate vicinity of the spot where I had thought to spend the night. Now that's no subject matter at all, and that's in Moby Dick. Now what does he call it, Faye? The landlord is skylarking him. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road, healthy, free, the world before me, the long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth, I ask not good fortune. I myself am good fortune. Henceforth, I whimper no more. Postpone no more, need nothing, done with indoor complaints, libraries, querulous criticism. Strong and content, I travel the open road.
Quite frankly, as far as I've been able to see, I mean, I know you're going to say I've just been blind, but Misty does not have as far as being sick and her reaction to it goes, she hasn't shown a strong personality.
As maybe Pussy would.
As Pussy would. Mm-hmm. Or as a lot of horses I've seen would. She seems to take it, if she even took it in her stride and didn't pay any attention to it at all, she would be showing more than she is. Because she likes her feeds, but she doesn't like having to stay in all night. Well, that's just normal. I mean, you know. And she doesn't mind having her shots, but I wouldn't say she looked forward to it either. I don't know. As horses go, she just hasn't been outstanding as far as in that respect, as far as I've seen.
Well, talk about Pussy and Pussy as a school horse.
A pretty good example of a good school horse, and I suppose you'll find. And she does a lot of things wrong, but I never met a school horse that didn't. And she'll do it right if you make her. And you get one of these kids out there, and they get on her, and she'll go. She won't just stand there and stand still, which is a little check mark in her favor right there. She may go a little bit fast sometimes. And I've had two or three of them down under the trees over there already.
Really?
Yeah. You see, the only way that they can get her to canter, because she has this thing about throwing her head. Not throwing her head, but, she won't turn is what it is. She just won't turn. Because they haven't got the balance to use the reins either one way or the other. Neck reining or direct reining. They can't do either one. Especially when they're learning to canter or to trot. So I tell them, well, just go straight down the fence line. Well, when they get so far down the fence line, then she just keep on going straight. And when they're cantering, they can't even stop. They're so busy thinking about staying on. But she goes. She doesn't just stand there and let them kick her sides to death while they get nothing from her. And if I get on her, she obeys me, which was a big check mark in her favor. Because it's awfully embarrassing for the instructors to get on a horse and have it not perform. And of course, I can make her do these circles and stuff. But I know really deep in my heart from the trouble I'm having doing it that they can't. But knowing that she will do it, I can, and being able to get up there and show them that she will do it, I have a little bit of room to talk. But she doesn't make it easy for them. She's not a horse that can just be gotten on and anybody can ride just and have her go perfectly. And that's both for and against her. It's for her, as far as I'm concerned. Because if they could just get on her and do whatever they wanted, and she just performed, then they'd never learn what they've got to learn. And when she goes trotting down there and sticks her nose up in the air and goes along with her head sideways and they can't turn her, either they get their balance so that they can, or they just go trotting down to the end of the fence. At which point she stops and turns her own accord. And if they're cantering up the other direction and can't brace their backs to stop her and she heads toward the gap, well, they either stop her or she goes through the gap. They learned either one way or the other, they've learned something. It was known as a rough school. She's funny. She's a horse that if, for instance, when Jay and David were out here, David get on her, and David hasn't had as much experience as Jay, and Pussy was just all over the place. She was wandering. She wouldn't go around the square, and he couldn't make her turn at the corners, and she was just all over the place. And Jay got on her, and with a little bit more experience, a little bit more balance, and that's all he had was a little bit more, and Pussy performed. And that's all I ask of a school horse, just about. She hadn't got balance, and she can't do some things yet. I was considering that not one of the riders she's got riding her knows much either. It doesn't bother. She knows more than they do, just so she can keep ahead of them. That's the opposite of the usual poach, but she knows more than they do. How to do a circle, they don't yet.
Yeah.
She knows how to obey a proper rein aid for everything except her lead. They don't know how to give it yet. So she's ahead of them, and that's the main thing.
Well, take some of the riders a little farther along. How would she be as a school horse?
All right, because she's young and she's learning. And when riders get a little bit more advanced, then they have to start learning how to train. They have to start thinking of themselves as always being training a horse. To realize that every time they're on a horse, they're in some sense teaching that horse something. And so they're ready to start working with a young horse to think about it. And teaching her something, you see. Like Claudia, I can put Claudia on a horse, on Pussy. And when Pussy doesn't do her circle right, I can say, all right, Claudia, make her do it right. And Claudia has just enough ability to make her do it right. And in doing so, she's not only taught herself how to do it, she's made Pussy do it. And so Pussy's learning.
This is Friday, November the 7th, after breakfast. This is Friday, November the 7th, after breakfast. Friday, 7th of November, after breakfast. It's the end of channel 2 over. The end of channel 2 over. I'll just read this little note from Faye, written on Halloween. On a scrap of paper. And it certainly hasn't been edited. You have to read between the lines. Starts off, this is that little bit about Aaron's houseboat, where Erin is going to be the mama. She's got I'm Gannat in her mind when she starts this. Also, she's got a little Whitman in her mind, as I see it. Spoons are for eating, not hitting on the head, walls, table, jelly, glass. My cocky, says Elliot, as if he hadn't just turned his milk over. So that's that child who knows he's done something wrong, but in order to appease his mama, right fast, he tells her that he's eaten what she's put before him. And then she does this thing that she has got from Whitman, in that she names everything. And she does this with the children, and they repeat. She says, cereal, peaches, hamburger, peanut butter, bread, milk, lemonade, toothbrushes, shorts, and she could just go on and on, naming objects. Now, Erin, this is evidently what Erin is doing. She's the mama, and she has told the children just what Faye said. Listened to Miles' footsteps as he carried the fish bait and ice down the pier. Now, this is exactly what the family does. Somebody has to take the fish bait, somebody has to take the ice, and they all have their little chores when they go to the houseboat. So Erin has designated little chores for her family. And then she can't resist this bit of color. The wood and the metal drum float, and the wood and the metal drum floats, metal drum floats, bounced and echoed under him. Let me read that again. Wood and the metal drum floats, bounced and echoed under him. She wanted him to run. Now, that's not the mama anymore. That's Erin switching to a little girl. She couldn't imagine Miles not running. And then she looks over the side of the boat, and she could see Brim eating the algae on the hull of the next houseboat. And then it seems right now that Faye has, this is her own statement, I don't believe this could be Erin's, gas spots floated on the water in pink and blue circles. A little out of character there.
So in reading that, you've got to see where Haim Gnat and Walt Whitman and Erin and Faye all come in.
I don't see her the way Faye does. To me, it's, she's, of all the horses I've taken care of, and the few that have been, I've seen that have been sick, I can't say that she seems to show a real strong personality about it. And she comes up and she likes the food, and that's all right. Most horses do. But she doesn't like staying up all night. And she doesn't like that box particularly. She likes the attention, but she doesn't get really affectionate about it. Not really affectionate about it. And, of course, I've never seen her when she had a case of colic. But she doesn't seem to beg for affection particularly. She takes it or leaves it as it comes. You open the door for her in the morning, and she walks right out and doesn't even say hello to you. She just heads for the nearest bit of grass. Now, I've had horses that have come up to you and thank you for everything you do for them. But not Missy. I've had horses that would come up to me, do something in the morning. I forget which horse it was now, but I can remember there was one horse that always would stop and thank me before he would go on and do anything else. Always he would stop and just say thank you before he would go on. When I turned him out or anything, he was always a gentleman. And Missy's not, see, she didn't, it's not that she's not affectionate, she's just not showing that much character. I'm sure she has a lot of character, but it's not coming out in her being sick. Because every horse has character, but it comes out in different ways. Sick to Missy, at least in this particular case, is not much of anything at all. The only thing about it is it annoys her a little to have to stay up at night.
Yeah.
And that's about it. when she's got sandcock, she shows a bit more, but... This isn't bothering her one way or the other. And it's not even as if she accepts it so calmly that that you notice that. Every way she reacts is so normal that it comes out to nothing. Well, he'd jump up and down on me and stall me.
You're right out of the room.
I'm rather fond of Missy, but she's a nice horse to take care of. She's no trouble.
Just not much fun.
She's no trouble except when she won't go in a dry stall when it's raining and it's dripping down the back of your neck. And she stands there and flattens her ears back and won't move, and breathing like a freight train. The one time I've gotten that out.
You were provoked, I could tell.
It's the only time she's ever done anything.
Down, she went out. That was right provoking.
Skippy cat. about things like that.
What?
She's a scaredy cat. She's a coward about things that might touch her or hit her. I had that blanket on, and I brought her out to feed her, and I just let her go in the stall with the blanket on before I took it off, because she'd be standing still. And the bareback pad hit the boards when she was walking in, and I never saw a horse back up so fast, and then just stand and shake. Now, I've seen horses that would run a saddle. I know one horse that took a saddle apart just walking through posts like that. He never even thought about it. But Missy acted like she had been stung by a whole nest of wasps when she tried to go through that post. Beat her through and hold the bareback pad so it wouldn't touch the post. Now, by means, when she says that if anything happens out on the road, the horse just stands there and shivers. Imagine, that's probably why she doesn't lie down very much in that box. There may be a couple of lumps in the straw.
Mm-hmm. She's that way about everything.
The princess, what is it?
The princess and the pea.
See, we're experimenting, and this is the end of this reel, Barbara Toole. This is the end of Channel 2 Over and the end of this reel. Barbara Toole, on Friday after breakfast, the 7th of November, 69. Friday after breakfast, 7th of November, 69.